apple soup and also get a handmade bowl. This is the place to go. So April 28th, 4 to 6 p.m., Empty Bowls Dinner. All right. It is time for our guest, and we are pleased to welcome Lee Baldwin. Lee is an author of speculative fiction and adventure fiction. He has already published 3 novels, Next History, The Girl Who Hacked Tomorrow, Angle of Attack, The Adventure and Adventure in Aviation, Love and Crime, and finally, Halcyon Dream Worlds, Enslaved in the Future of Desire. And his latest book, Aliens Got My Sally, is scheduled to come out on May 4th. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you. It feels great to be here.
We're just so glad you could be in the studio with us today, and always love an opportunity to just get talking about more literature out there and getting people reading.
Yeah.
The Rogue Valley is a literate place.
Yes, yes. Definitely. It's wonderful. So, tell us a little bit about the whole idea of speculative fiction, because it's something that it's maybe not really clear in our listeners' minds what that is. We know genre fiction, we know mysteries, we know romance, we know literary fiction, but we don't know necessarily what speculative fiction is.
Let me circle around to that, if I may.
Sure.
From a little news item that I have this morning. Coming out on May 4th on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Kobo is my new ebook, as you mentioned, science fiction novel about first alien contact. Aliens Got My Sally, subtitled is UFO Pulp Fiction for the Modern Mind. Now, we have a lot of modern minds in the Rogue Valley. In this story, an archaeologist extracts a coded message from a pre-Columbian sculpture disclosing that Earth is a failed colony of an ancient galactic race. Humanity will not be amused. Now, overall, this novel asks what would we look like to an advanced interstellar species which has survived a billion years. Aliens Got My Sally is a novel of first interstellar contact that doesn't bring you a space armada, which is de rigueur these days, but centers on the lost sense of self in each of us that denies our true nature and our ability to cooperate as a species. So that's part of the setup. And the setup in speculative fiction comes from a lot of different directions. For example, one of the things that I like to write about in all of my science fiction is, what will it take to mend the world? And I look at that through the lens of the most advanced science I can find. And the nature of consciousness, quantum mechanics and quantum physics, where did the universe come from, all of these things. And so one of the theses of this book is, what would a very advanced interstellar species do to ensure their survival in a very distant time? Suppose there was an alien race out there that said, we have to make sure that we're around in a billion years. And so in the reader's mind, it starts setting up this comparison. We're not a billion years old yet, are we? You know, we're something like a couple of hundred thousand as a species and as a race. So to get back to your original question, Michael, about speculative fiction, it's a little bit of a mongrel genre. It's a mixture of horror, of science fiction, of thriller and suspense, and so on. And it's a little bit more relaxed in terms of its boundaries because people started crossing them a lot and going into something that was undefined. So people defined it as speculative fiction.
Right. So what... when people go and get this, because it's coming out on May 4th, so they have a little anticipation of waiting for this book to come out. What are you kind of hoping this sparks in your readers?
Well, Michael can tell you this because of all the writing he's done, but it's a chance for people to examine themselves and the lives they're living in a way that is extremely light. It's not a lecture. It's not. But all of fiction strives to give you a little dopamine rush when certain things happen, like anticipation, success, failure. And writers work toward this. If you can see how a scene is set up, for example, you'll see that there's a very logical sequence of steps that the writer takes to produce a reaction in people. And when you get a visceral reaction, you gain some knowledge. Mm-hmm. Readers are looking for two things, entertainment, and they're also trying to understand how somebody else would handle a situation. And so, again, as Michael well understands, the thing you do with your character is heap grief on them. Mm-hmm. That's what you do. You're trying to stretch this character to the breaking point. And an entertaining writer will look around for things that haven't been tried before in terms of getting those nerve endings working.
Yeah. The old rule from Kurt Vonnegut is just to take your protagonist and just push him through all kinds of mayhem and misery.
Yeah.
So that the reader may find out what he's made of or she is made of. Yeah. Mm. So indeed. So speculative fiction, thank you for that introduction. But you seem to be drawn to the future.
I am drawn to the future. My first novel, as you mentioned at the top of the show, was Angle of Attack. And that's basically a straight-ahead mystery novel set in the worlds of sailplane flying. Mm-hmm. Why do I look to the future? Because it's a way to set a target that could be useful in people's self-examination and in their entertainment, too. Mm-hmm. You know, the science fiction writers that we know about, like Ari Lafferty and Larry Niven and L. Sprague de Camp and Arthur C. Clarke, et cetera, they all were literate authors. And this is one of the interesting things that struck me when I began to understand science fiction as a younger person, that there was a very literary bent in a lot of these people, and they also wrote essays. I said, this is odd for a genre writer. And they also wrote in other genres, too. Am I getting to your question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, something intrigues you about the future in a way that, as you know, you, like all writers, you're hoping to to get people to see something that they might have otherwise not seen.
That's right. And there's a very important observation there, that the future doesn't have the same baggage. It has almost no baggage. So you talk about world creation in a novel. You can create a world that doesn't have any emotional baggage until you build it in as the author.
Right.
And that way you can shape the story. You can kind of clean up the mind. It's like getting the reader to take a deep breath and start in on this with completely new assumptions.
Right. And it certainly allows for the reader to have that suspension of disbelief as they enter into that, because you've created this safe space. There's no, their mind isn't like, well, that's wrong. That's not going on right now. You know, they can really kind of just open themselves to, but anything's possible in the future.
That's right. It, to your point, you know, it does kind of clean the mind. It lets them look at a situation where they can drop all their current worries. It has to be enough different from what's going on in their face day after day in our media. At the same time, be entertaining, be riveting, something that actually gets hold of them. And they can let their own imagination run, and they can start to say, wait, you said something earlier, and now this character is going down that road. It's a big mistake. Don't do it. And at that point, they don't realize it. But what you do is you have them caring for your character.
Yeah, indeed. So you've given us a short intro to Aliens Got My Sally. But you want to tell us a little bit more about how this person, is it anthropologist?
No. Yeah, she's an anthropologist. Uh-huh. The two characters are anthropologists heading toward their PhD degrees. Sally is the title character. Her friend Anna Lewis is, they've been friends since girlhood. And in the very first page, Sally disappears. And I've got a one-minute reading of that chapter if you want to throw that in at some point. It's kind of interesting.
Well, actually, if you want to do it right now, 1 minute, that would be not bad.
Oh, would that be a good thing to do? Sure.
I think we might as well get the listeners intrigued.
Okay. Chapter one of Aliens Got My Sally. Quantum biologist Sally Jacobs will discover how freaky the universe can be when a corner of it opens up and swallows her whole. That won't be because she took a few minutes at the campus cafe or because that made her late to observe tonight's lunar eclipse with a friend. It won't be because she follows this deserted shortcut to avoid the shadowed parking lot where carousing frat boys smash car windows, or because of the towering rebreathers that roar against your intended sky. Sally's fate will unfold because 4 out of 5 infants on this overheated planet are born dead, because half of all humanity goes to bed starving, and because, like everyone else, she wears a breather mask to keep the poisoned atmosphere from killing her. Focused on leaving a voice message for her friend, she doesn't notice the little raccoon in the twilight until she's almost on it. The raccoon is very cute. Sally halts, a smile tugging at her lips. The animal is playing with a yellow ball, which now rolls toward her. With a sense of the weird cute, she reflexively toes the ball in the raccoon's direction. The animal bats it back, but not hard enough. Because Sally is a biologist to her core, she is fascinated with this intelligent behavior and by the fact that the raccoon has green eyes. But she knows that most wildlife has died off, so how can this one survive out here with no breather? She steps forward to kick the ball. The little face remains unreadable as its delicate clawed hands manipulate a crystal cylinder. The air around them shimmers gold. Clouded in incandescence, Sally tries to retreat. But when she finds herself unable to move, paralyzing fear rises to choking terror. She vanishes from the ordinary universe, along with the green-eyed raccoon and every living bacterium within 20 meters, hating it, that her only part in this cosmic discovery is that of the screaming blonde.
All right. I can see how what you said earlier really is starting to work already. This idea that, you know, we just take for granted that everybody is wearing breather masks because we can sort of imagine a future where that is a case, you know. Mm. So you just really got us into that situation already. Very nicely done indeed. Yeah. Good. So I want to just talk a little bit about your other work. You said that Angle of Attack is set in the current times, and you are a sailplane pilot, are you not?
That's right. In the 90s, up mm-hmm. to about 2002, I was learning to fly and then flying gliders. And mm-hmm. I will tell you that when I got up on my first tow of my first solo after the instructor got out, I said, "What am I doing here?" But learning to fly glider is as much book work as cockpit work. Yeah. There's really a lot. It's governed by the FAA. There are a lot of rules and restrictions and technicalities of just staying in the air that are extremely important. And I got fixated on this thing that's called weight and balance. Mm-hmm. Even airline pilots worry about it, because if the weight is too far backward, the plane won't nose down and it'll stall. So in a tandem glider, pilot in front, pilot in back, you have an opportunity for the pilot in the front to be too light. Mm. And if he happens to be a paid assassin, you have the opportunity for him to jump out with a parachute, leaving the pilot in the back with an airplane that's not even an airplane anymore. It will not fly. Oh. And so that is the setup in the first chapter of Angle of Attack, where Cicero Clay, who claims he is innocent, the very first line, it's like, "I am Ishmael." In the first line of the thing, he says, "I am innocent. I didn't do it. I can prove it." And then he has this lesson from this man that wants to fly aerobatics, who is a proficient pilot. And they're up and he says, "This guy doesn't need a lesson." And all of a sudden, he's jumped out.
So there we go.
And so the plot begins. Now, you, in the first chapter, there you are throwing grief on your protagonist.
Yes, indeed. That's how it starts out, yeah. I do remember flying in a relatively small plane a long time ago to Bonaire. And after everybody was on the plane, the pilot says, "Okay, you three people have to move forward." just to balance out the plane, you know, wow. because there weren't as many people on the plane as they had booked or something like that. So that's a good reminder that balance is important.
If you got a second, I have one more little item about that, just to take it back into the world of the here and now. Mm-hmm. In the second chapter, Cicero Clay finds that he's been assigned to a new parole agent who happens to be his high school girlfriend.
Oh.
So here's another way to dump grief on your protagonist.
Yes, indeed. Okay.
Well, and also just with getting back to Aliens Took My Sally, is that, you know, just in what you read to us, is that even though it's set in the future, she's still dealing with those same problems that, especially for a lot of young women, can really relate to, of I'm avoiding that parking lot that I know that there's a bunch of rowdy men in, and there's, you know, things like that, that even though she's in the future, she still gets coffee in the quad, you know, in college and things like that. And just, but, and showing, and you already care about her because, like, oh, good, she loves raccoons and she's playing ball with a raccoon. Now I love her. So I think that's a really wonderful way of, the fact that you want to get people sunk in so fast.
Right. You have to keep it recognizable. Some of the fantasy books that just completely make me slam them shut, they give me 10 very oddball names in the first two pages. So I'm supposed to know and remember these things, let alone care about them. It just doesn't work.
Because ultimately you're almost having to start with your creation origin story for that book, and then you can start getting into the details. And that's
right.
difficult for a lot of readers.
Yeah. Right. And the rule for me is start with something familiar. I'm a jazz player. And so when you get up to play Autumn Leaves, you don't start with the most wigged out solo you ever found. You start out with Autumn Leaves, as most people will recognize it.
Indeed.
And then you take them along. You take this harmony and that harmony, and you get them into the swing of you're doing something different with something that they already understand. Same thing for literature.
Exactly.
I like that a lot.
That's a very good analogy. I like that a lot. Yeah. You want to tell us quickly a little bit about your other books? I know that you have a little a collection of short stories, what you call Western Noir, called Lance Sidesaddle.
Lance Sidesaddle is a private investigator of the American West.
Uh-huh.
He lives in a time warp in Prescott, Arizona. He thinks that it's 1850, and he has the dress, the style, the mannerisms, the politeness that went with those times, the frontier times in the high desert of Arizona. And you can't find his office, but around sundown, all of his stories start at sundown, he comes down the stairs from a second floor on Whiskey Row in Prescott, Arizona, where his office used to be. But in doing that, he walks into the present. And so he hops in a pickup truck that he calls Old Paint, because the paint is old. And he wears his one spur snakeskin boots to go around. And he's very much of a Don Quixote character. He is somebody, most humor is directed at him, and a lot of it goes right over his head. I had a very wonderful review from someone who really saw into those stories. They said, this stuff is very difficult to write because you have a sympathetic character who is not the brightest star in the sky, right?
Right.
And he's trying to solve crimes. And the way he bumbles through it is part dumb luck and part the fact that the universe just likes him.
Right. Especially with someone trying to use 1850s criteria for solving present day crimes. Just trying to imagine how those two weave together is quite a fascinating idea.
That's exactly right. He solves one fire by telling the local detective. He always outwits the local detective. He says, I've got the reason for your fire, the house fire. Well, what is it? He says, it was friction. It was the mortgage rubbing up against the insurance policy.
That will certainly start a fire, let me tell you.
Definitely.
Oh, that's great.
Wonderful. Anyways, thanks for coming in, and thanks for all the insight. Where can people find out more about your book, especially the one that's coming up?
The easiest way to find any and all about me and about Aliens Got My Sally is just do a search for Aliens Got My Sally.
Okay.
Very nice.
Good. All right. Thanks, Lee, for coming in and telling us about your writing and your various books and your characters and providing a definition for... what's the word?
Speculative fiction.
Right.
Man, we always got to have a box, don't we?
Thank you, Michael. Exactly. Thank you, Ellen. It was fun.
Oh, a pleasure to have you here with us.
Wonderful indeed.
And thank you to all of our listeners who have been with us through this interview. Mm-hmm. Lee Baldwin has just been a joy to have with us during Pledge Week. And if you like hearing from wonderful members of the community like Lee Baldwin, you should give us a call at 541-482-3999 and pledge your support right now.
Indeed.
Because this is how we keep it going, and this is why we want to bring people like this in, so that the community's getting engaged in what everyone else is doing.
Exactly. We are approaching the end of the morning show here, so this is another incentive for you all to...